Committee on Audit and Human Service Budget Reform to order. Thank you, Representative Bates, for joining us. Today is Tuesday, March 11th. We have most of our members here. And we are, as scheduled, having a public hearing today, input on the draft recommendations for changes to the Oregon Health Plan and the state's mental health delivery system. We won't necessarily restrict it to that. Any announcements from staff? I'd like to announce to everyone, committee members and attendees, that we will have a rare day off tomorrow. So,
it's my birthday.
It's your birthday?
In honor of Dr. Greenlee's birthday.
Well, and that's, I knew that, so that's why we were doing that. The, it's Representative Greenlee's birthday.
Tomorrow.
So, speaking of birthdays, we will call first to the stand the wife of an individual who turns 55 today. Is there anyone in the audience who happens to fit that description? Well, I haven't said any names. However, you are required. And Margaret, talk
right into the microphone.
Right into the microphone.
Okay. For the record, my name is Margaret Taylor, and I think you have the materials I brought in with me today. Today I am before you as a healthcare consultant, and I jumped into that title late last night sometime when I realized that some of the things that I've been seeing with the changes and the proposals to the Oregon Health Plan and the potential elimination of the mental health and chemical dependency services out of the Oregon Health Plan made me very alarmed. And so, and I'm sure I know you have been up every night going to these meetings, and I know the amount of work that the committee members have been engaging in this process, but I thought maybe I could throw in my 2 cents worth. You have my materials in front of you. To start with, I was looking at the governor's balanced budget, and I have some alternative proposals. I work in the managed care unit for Marion County, so I've been involved in the administration of the delivery of the systems here for 2 years before that. And then I've also worked out at the jail and the crisis centers, my history with this. My proposals are to maintain the delivery infrastructure, but change the emphasis of that structure and streamline it. And maybe what I'll do is I'll just go into the other pages as my handouts.
I'm actually interested in that statement. So can you flesh that out, Margaret?
Yeah, I'd be happy. Go to page 3. And there has been concerns about the multiple layers of administration. We have the state system. We have the county systems. We have the managed, the mental health care organization systems. And we also have the provider organizations. And part of the problem was a CAMEL was created, and so right now what you've got in those systems is, in fact, a CAMEL. If you look at the mental health organization agreement that we operate under, it's about 3 inches thick. And remember, at the time that it started out, there was a great deal of concern because we were moving from a fee-for-service system. We were also moving services out of the traditional Department of Human Services. And we also had a lot more money at that time. So there were a lot of concerns about how this all would work, and the agreement reflects that. For example, in our agreements, we have to coordinate and integrate services with inpatient care, alcohol and drug, PCPs. All those are good things. But we also have to coordinate care with mental health services, local mental health authorities, community emergency services, local and or regional allied agencies. And if you look in the back of my handouts, I've copied off different pages of the contract. For example, if you look at page 14 of the contract, you see that This presentation is very high-tech with my scrawl at the bottom.
That's great.
Look at delivery system requirements, so it'd be page 14. As a mental health organization, we're required to do a needs assessment. Okay, we've got our needs assessment. We're supposed to take into account social indicators, divorce rate, single parent household rate, homelessness rate, teenage pregnancy rate. And then we're supposed to take samples of those behaviors, rates of incarcerated persons, alcohol and drug-related motor vehicle accidents, fatalities, driving under the influence of intoxicating, domestic violence, elder abuse, nursing facility resident-to-resident abuse rates, diagnoses, school dropout rates, foster care density, and crime rates. All of those things were dumped into our contract. And if you look at some of the other system requirements, they all focus on integrating essentially all of the local services, the whole social service arraignment in each area. And I think part of it was that concern about startup, what would happen. People really didn't know what they needed to do. But when you hear the fellow come in from the mental health organization, I think it was last Thursday from Lane County, and the other fellow from across the river, Seth Bernstein, and you hear them talking about all the meetings that they're going to, and they're meeting here, and they're doing this, and they've got consumers involved here, and the consumers are involved there at each level of the organization. Remember that these are all requirements under the contracts that we're living under. These are not county-generated mental health organization requirements that we created internally. These are all the requirements that were put on the plans when we got started. And a lot of this coordination type work were requirements that we had that we operated under.
Do you know how many, if any, of those are federal requirements?
The coordination requirements and these type, the ones that I've got listed here, I think the quality assurance may be federally mandated, but I think a lot of these were generated at the time because it was a new system, but now that we've got some time are not required federally.
Representative Bates.
I had two questions. You asked the first one already. I'm breaking my promise to you that I would not ask questions in here today, and I just can't control myself, please. You get about 8% for administrative overhead for most of these programs. I assume that's correct for you?
Yes.
If you were allowed to eliminate those requirements you feel no longer have value, could you drop that to 7%, 6%? Well, how much of your time and effort is tied up doing these things? If they were eliminated, what would that percentage look like to you?
I think right now, in order to maintain the infrastructure and the overall relationships, that would be a priority that we would work with. Because I think it's more important right now to reduce those types of things and maintain client services than to insist upon these and maybe build them back in later when we see what actual abuses we encounter. But so I can't speak. I'm here as a healthcare consultant. I can't speak for my organizations or the county organizations. But I think.
She whispered something.
She didn't whisper a darn thing.
And
what's your next question?
And I think that what she whispered was that she's not certain, but she would look at it. Thank you.
Sorry.
I was just going to say, there's a free pharmaceutical program that physicians can enjoy, anti-question-taking pills. Ask as many as you want, Representative.
I am approved. Thank you.
To continue on, I also have some of the prevention requirements that we've got. Also, I've got the quality assurance requirements we live under. I've got a description of access requirements. We have to have a face-to-face or an actual person on the telephone within 15 minutes of a telephone call. And really, if the mental health urgent is that urgent, they should just go to ER or call the police. So some of the access requirements that have been designed really are overly restrictive with what we need. And part of it, that was just startup, concerns about startup. So another change we could make is that the general access for non-urgent routine services were held to a two-week requirement. We're supposed to get people in within 2 weeks. and I can't get someone in on the private side within 2 weeks. And so that's another requirement that would reduce our cost of service and reduce the cost of the system. You also see we've I've put in a sample of, this is the Marion County chart review process when we go in and do licensure at the state, our contract.
Where are you, Margaret?
Pardon?
Where are you in your handout?
It's this one here. Oops, and actually I tried, please ignore the name of the provider that's up at the top. There's no... There's no data involved.
Brand X,
Brand
County.
X. Hey. But these are what we go through when we go into our provider. These are the chart requirements that we have when we go into our provider organizations that they must operate under for adults and children. And once again, it's a lot of concerned individuals wanting to make sure that their dollars are spent wisely. But one has to wonder at this time, maybe the focus really needs to be on direct client services and maybe some of the... We should reduce some of these requirements. The Lane County information, apparently someone referred to, I've been listening to the tapes, said about they have an hour of administrative services for each hour of it. And this is part of the reason why. So we've talked a little bit. If we will go back to my main presentation, page 4, I've talked a little bit about the coordination and kind of explained why mental health organizations and counties spend so much time coordinating things with everyone. And then I've also talked about the access requirements, and I've also talked about the charting requirements that are in place for the agencies. Another good reason not to change the course, not to completely to revise the delivery system and to keep the services in the Oregon Health Plan, is that a lot of small agencies, you need extensive information services. And a lot of agencies, counties, groups, MVIPA, you heard Dean Andretta come in from the MITCHIP organization, have spent enormous sums on putting information systems into place so we can actually implement the services. And Marion County, 50% of our services are private and nonprofit organizations. And so each one of the little children's guild down the street needed an information system deal to hook up to our computer so they could get payment, so they could get clients authorized, and that they could get counted for the services that they got. So if you completely change the ship at this point, all of that money is down the drain, and we rethink the whole darn thing. And this is just not the time to do that. Also, if you cut jobs, the jobs that you're cutting, I just calculated that for each $60,000, $60,000, and you guys are used to hearing millions, I mean, in this group, for each $60,000 you cut, I imagine we lose one staff worker, QMHEA, QMHP, dollar spent right in our economy. Children's Guild, Northwest Human Services, all of our local providers, private providers as well as county. On the next page, page 5, the system we've got is built on the encounter data system, and I imagine you've heard a bit about encounter data. It means each activity that the provider does has to be put into their database system, which has to go into a kind of mainframe database system and then goes up to the state system. And that is federally required. But that type of, it rewards those people that are still on fee-for-service systems and penalizes counties such as Marion County that has switched to a case rate system, where we've really worked with the providers to really manage their services more on a lower cost per client basis. We also, in our system, we require authorizations for service levels over $1,200 per year. I think on Lane County, they were talking about they only audit after 70, if it's over 70 visits per client per year. So there's a huge difference. So how do we do it? The total mandatory program, what I was reading on the handout from last Thursday, is $442.2 million. But I really wonder how long that number will last. If you look at that second page, that integration between inpatient and outpatient, combining that into one risk pool so that whoever is providing the services is really driven to drive down those inpatient costs. In the Mid-Valley BCN region, that's this five-county region, we've reduced our cost. The savings have been about $1 million a year. That may be, you know, I had to use comparables from 1995, days per 1,000 eligibles, and maybe that's a little bit higher pool than we've got now since we've expanded it. But compared 85.36 days per 1,000 per year eligibles compared to now 56.9. I mean, we've brought it down 30 days. And that adds up. That's just this five-county region. That's about $1 million saved. So if you separate out the inpatient, keep the inpatient, which is mandated, and get rid of the outpatient mental health, this number, you're going to be paying for it, and they're going to call you back in about 3 months after everybody's gone home and say, look, this is exploding. So let's not go there. The other thing, so I talked about that, prescription drugs. This is when we lost the OHP standard for mental health. The biggest difficulty we faced was trying to maintain some continuity of care, even when we had drugs available for prescriptions, when we had the coverage before March 1st. Who was going to prescribe them? Because the local PCPs don't want our clients. They're on an average of five medications, five antipsychotics. They don't want our clients in their offices. Who will prescribe the medications if you eliminate outpatient mental health benefits? The prescription drugs are also the most likely source of savings in behavioral drugs. In a Texas report that I can provide to Rick, they've increased from 18 to 22%. Behavioral drugs are a greater proportion of your drug costs, and the cost per client is higher. Marion Polk Health Plan had a 20% savings. So I think there's definitely savings in terms of if we work better with the pharmacies. On the next page, page 7, I think mental health and addiction services should be combined into one carve-out, into the mental health carve-out. And we had meetings at just yesterday at Marion County. So we have the Marion County group, which is the mental health services, and then we also are working on administering the addiction services. And it was the same people in the room. We first sat there for 2 hours with the same providers, and then all of them stayed, and some people moved, and some people came in, and some people came out. And then it's the same providers that were there for the next 2 hours. So there is no logical reason for separating that out into two different. And there would be some savings there with combining the two. And so after you've done that, after you've worked on the prescription drug formulary, combining those two services, reducing the state requirements so we're just focusing on treatment services, and then filling in any missing funds from the governor's proposed plan for DHS budget, I think we can do it and keep the structure intact and keep the good parts of the system and look for better days. Yeah, thank you very, very much for your time.
Oh, no, thank you. I've got to tell you, I really, really, really appreciate your testimony. I mean, we know there's a problem, but we don't need to hear there's a problem. That's why we're here. You came with real solutions, and that's hard to do. Yeah. We appreciate you. Any questions for Margaret?
Thank you.
You tell Bill happy birthday for us.
I will do that. Thank you.
Kim Scott and Robert Roy. Enter and sign in, please, and get real friendly with those microphones.
Okay. My name is Kim Scott. I'm from Trillium Family Services. Trillium Family Services, an merged organization that consists of Perry Center for Children and Waverly Children's Home in Portland and Children's Farm Home in Corvallis. We're here to talk about concerns regarding the Oregon Health Plan and some concerns that we have regarding some of the innovative programming that we see happening within the health plan. A few years back, Children's Farm Home entered into a relationship with the Mental Health Division Behavioral Care Network and Accountable Behavior Health, two MHOs in the Mid-Willamette Valley. And we implemented, under a budget note with the Mental Health Division, we implemented an intensive treatment services pilot at the farm home. And the typically, in the intensive treatment services, those are high-end residential programs that are a step below hospitalization. It's essentially a fairly expensive level of care, and it's a level of care that we're paid. The dollars associated with a bed. So if, for instance, using a number like 20, we get paid for 20 beds. In the pilot, after our partnership with the MHOs and the division, we were able to operate under the health plan in a flexible funding environment where we were able to be paid for 20 slots rather than just 20 beds. And in that model, we were able to move kids through a variety of services, including residential, day treatment, therapeutic foster care, outpatient, in-home support, in-school support, the idea of an array of services to follow children. And our belief at the time was that we, given that model, and by moving kids out of residential arenas, that we would be able to treat more children annually, and that we would also have better outcomes. And since that pilot was implemented in 1999, there have been two studies, one conducted by our internal research committee with representatives from the University of Washington, Portland State, University of Oregon, and another study conducted over a two-year period from the OMAS. And essentially what we found is that our assumption at the beginning was that with the budget note we could develop a full array of services and a system of care, and that step-down services, lower-end services, would emerge as a treatment of choice, and that we would serve at least the same number of children and children with at least the same severity in terms of problems, and that annually we would serve more children. So initially one of the things that we really did was we almost entered into a performance based contracting with the managed care entities and the state. And after doing this pilot for 4 years, what the data is showing is that the child's length of stay in a facility is shorter. The average length of stay in residential treatment is around 300 days. In our pilot, kids are in that program for about 81 days. There were focus groups done with all of the families, and the family members and children report that they're very satisfied with the ITS pilot program. Children in the pilot are returning to a family or a relative's home at a higher rate. Children in the pilot, about 70% of those kids return home compared to about 38% in our traditional program. I think the reason that is that under the health plan and under the fact that we have this flexible array of services, families feel much more supported and able to receive kids in their home because they know that we'll be able to leverage support into the home when there's a crisis. We're serving more children who have the same or higher psychiatric acuity level as children participating in our traditional contracting system. And that the ITS pilots have also shown a lower readmission rate into the same or higher level of care. For the 2 years that the state looked at the program, only 1% of the kids after 180 days were readmitted into the same or higher level of care, compared to 8% in the traditional psych res system. And then I guess the other positive outcome is that over that period of time, we served about 10% more children for the same dollars than we would have in a traditional contracting mechanism. And I guess what we're here to talk about is just the fact that we believe that we were able to do this, that we were able to maintain this kind of creativity, flexibility, and efficiency, largely due to our ability to function under the health plan, and that our hope is, regardless of how the health plan is managed in the future, that we're able to continue operating programs. Because I think if in this kind of a manner, because I think if we go back to just a straight Medicaid contracting relationship, there's unintended consequences in terms of efficiencies, outcomes, and then how children and families are served in community settings. I think that's pretty much it for me.
Robert?
Chair Westland and members of the committee, my name's Robert Roy, and I'm also from Trillium Family Services. I think Kim provided a pretty good overview. Our concern overall within the health plan is the children served, and not only that we serve, but out throughout the state of Oregon. And I think that we feel strongly that these are some of the most severe children that with mental health needs in the state, and that I think we found an effective way to provide services. And overall, we're just concerned that as we move forward to plan about the health plan, that we make sure that we maintain the ability to serve children in this manner. I think that the one thing that Kim mentioned, I want to stress, is that through this kind of innovative programming, we're able to return children to their own homes and to their own communities. And I think that the figure is somewhere around 70 or 75% of the children go home, whereas under the traditional residential model, without the flexible funding, it's around 50%. So we're really encouraged by the results and want to ensure that it is maintained. It's also more cost-effective.
We'd also like to say that, you know, Children's Farm Home is one pilot. There are now five pilots across the state. And in the ITS system, there's a total of some 300 beds, and about a third of those are now involved in pilot activities. And essentially, as providers, what we would like to see is that they're no longer pilots, but that they become the way and the system for doing business in terms of treating these children in high-end programs. And so what we don't want to see the loss of momentum.
Questions? Representative Greenlee.
I don't have my medication up to date either. I first want to comment. I visited with Twelton Valley's similar program. My daughter taught for 5 years in a OHSU's program. These things are very impressive. What happens if OHP goes away for big portions of the population? Do you imagine there are other sources of finances in the community to pay for keeping these programs operational, at least at some level?
Even in today's funding environment, the state of Oregon, in terms of our level of care, really pays about somewhere between 80 and 90% of the cost of care. And so already we're subsidizing the programs operationally to the tune of about $2 million a year that we generate funds through the private arena. I guess my belief is that residential alternatives to hospitalization or hospitalization are always going to, you're going to need that level of care for kids. And without the health plan, I would see us going back to some type of a system that would be more of a straight Medicaid. And the loss there is that in this model, kids, not only are they able to go home, but we can continue to follow them once they're placed in their home. We can follow them in home, in school, back to their community. If this were to go away, what would end up happening is that kids would stay for a specific time within a level of care and discharged with no appropriate follow-up. And what typically happens with that is that kids then go back out into the community into the next atrocity, whatever that is, and then they re-enter some form of treatment, which is usually at the high end, which is very expensive.
May I follow up on that? Yeah, let me try a little. Let me try and push that just a little bit. I had a conversation at the New Twelton Valley Center with a parent who not only was paying his own way, some of which was covered through health insurance, but was driving from Gresham to Tigard four times a day in order to deal with program needs. Are there most of the emotionally disturbed kids in the state are not on Medicaid? Most of the emotionally disturbed kids, numerically, are our sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters and a variety of other things. But I sense that these kind of experimental programs are very much public finance oriented rather than covered through private health insurance, covered through family resources. And I'm very much in favor of first dollar coverage for the whole set of services here, because it really is a part of education and a variety of other things. But I was just wondering if there are not some imaginative ways to piece together funding for a variety of slots. And I don't mean trying to get the extra 20% when you're only paid 80% by the state. I'm talking about getting half of those slots in private funding to help your programs and to help kids, not just to deal with the with the Oregon Health Plan.
Representative Greenleck, if I can respond, you know, Trillium's primary source of funding is through government contracts. But also, we are talking about the very same thing. I do believe that to respond to the total need, there's going to be have to be a new type of approach, which not only includes the state, but includes private foundations, corporations, and businesses. If we're going to readdress this problem, we're very interested in trying to find other resources of funding. And I think, you know, private funding is one source, but I think it's going to take, you know, more than just the state and private foundations and individuals. It's something we as a community and public need to take on, and I think that needs to be addressed, and we're very interested in pursuing that.
We'd better.
That's right.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Any other questions?
So, if I can sum up here just a little bit, what, in addition to general overall funding, I mean, you are very concerned about keeping the flexibility that allows the community integrated system to go forth. Okay.
Chairman, can I make a comment on that?
Of course.
Absolutely. You know, the current funding model through a waiver. Medicaid waiver has allowed us to flex those dollars, those residential dollars, and develop this full array of services. If the health plan, you know, goes away or changes, or we lose that relationship ability with the HMOs, that flexibility may also go away. And that will then, the funding from the state will then be, as I understand it, will be a direct so much per slot, and the flexibility, being able to flex the funds will go with it. And I believe, frankly speaking, we have enough evidence now just to know that without that flexibility, the results and outcomes will be less desirable than they are now.
Where are the five pilots located?
Southern Oregon, Grants Pass, there's an ITS provider there. There's one in Clackamas County, Multnomah County, Washington County. The farm home pilot actually covers 12 counties, and the relationship with Accountable Behavioral Health and Behavioral Care Network, we're spread across 12 counties.
And what MHO is that associated with?
Accountable Behavioral Health in Benton County, and then BCN here in Salem.
Very good. Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming here today. Art, Arlene Daniel, and Debbie Hammond. Was it Adrian? Well, you're only going to keep us in suspense for so long because. Enter and sign in, please. And again, talk right into the mic so we, A, we get it on tape, and B, the folks in the back can hear.
Chair Westland and the members of the Audit Committee. For the record, my name is Debbie Hammond, and I'm a home care worker for 2 years. I was a home care worker for 2 years, and my client passed away. I was not eligible for the Oregon Health Plan while providing home care services because I was over income. I have congestive heart failure, asthma, and other health care issues. When my client passed away, I was denied coverage through the Oregon Health Plan because they considered my last 3 months of income, even though it was from a terminated source. I have been hospitalized twice in the last 2 months, and since I have no coverage, I am responsible for the cost of both hospital visits. I have no way to pay for those charges. I am supposed to take medication, but I can't afford it. The Oregon Health Plan is the only safety net for many just like me. The doctors at the hospital said I needed to have more tests run, but they can't because I have no insurance, and I have no way to pay for them. Going to the emergency room for care that could be prevented by medication and preventative health care doesn't make sense to me. The Oregon Health Plan helps keep the cost of health care down. If you maintain your initial recommendations to only look at ways to fund the minimum federal requirements, you are essentially saying to me and many others who are much more at risk that we don't matter. You are saying to those who have employer-sponsored health insurance that it's okay for them to pick up the cost of health care for the uninsured. Everyone should have access to health care. As legislators, I am asking you to consider what is in the best interest of our state and citizens. Establish that policy and then look for ways to make it happen. I have a lot to offer seniors and people with disabilities as a caregiver. I love my work and love caring for our seniors. I cannot be there for those who need me when I'm unable to care for myself. Thank you.
Thank you, Debbie. I think you very articulately expressed the cost shift issue that we're all wrestling with. And that's a huge issue.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Is it Adrian?
Adrian. My name is Adrian Daniel. I want to thank you for allowing us to be here. I am an employee of the Oregon Health Plan. I am not here as a representative of the Oregon Health Plan. I'm here only as a citizen. I do not have a prepared script. I was asked yesterday to join you. I'm an eligibility specialist. I look at applications, determine eligibility for such people as Debbie, and then have the unfortunate job of frequently denying benefits to people like Debbie. I guess I most relate not to the exclusion of other clients, but I do relate to Debbie because I see this frequently, having to deny people in this age group services that they have no other place to go. Protecting the Oregon Health Plan, I think, is the ultimate concern right now. I would just like to tell you that I am one of probably, I don't really know the numbers, maybe 125 other workers. Right now, the morale is at a low at OHP. Daily, we get phone calls from people like Debbie, from extremely upset, frustrated people who have no place else to turn, desperate people. It's created a very stressful environment at OHP. We've had the employee assistance program come and give three sessions to all of our workers because it is on a daily basis. It can be sad, very sad. I would like to personally urge the committee to find a way to fund OHP.
Any questions? Adrian, how many clients do you assess a day? Round numbers.
We have a standard of 15 that we're supposed to work 15 applications a day. And we may have contact with each client more than just once.
Sure.
So we deal with anywhere from 5 to 10, depending on actually the time of the month, so where we may have many phone calls in addition to the applications that we work daily.
This is probably an unanswerable question, but round numbers during a busier than normal, fairly busy time, how many phone calls from clients concerned about eligibility will you field in a day?
I've had as many. This may not sound like a lot, but frequently a dozen. When you're trying to, of recent days, we're trying to encourage those people to look for resources at pharmacies, or places where they can get medication. That's the hugest concern right now. We may spend 15 or 20 minutes with a client, and we do have resources, and I understand from Debbie that she's tried to access some of these pharmacy resources to no avail at all. So I just learned that from her today. Debbie and I have never met before, by the way, and she enlightened me with her story today. She's tried to access some of these resources that we give out to our clients, and she has no success with it. but we might spend 10 or 15, maybe 20 minutes with a client trying to offer resources for them.
Sure.
And then how many of those would you, you know, have to deal in a fairly stressful, disturbing, give them disturbing news? We can't help you. Here's a place to turn. Of those 12?
My goodness, I don't, maybe four or five. We deny people medical on a daily basis. We talk to them on the phone. I'm sorry, you are $20 over income. You're $15 over income.
So of that 12 spontaneous phone calls, you pick up the phone, 30 or 40% you're denying.
I don't want to put a percentage on it.
Right.
I honestly don't know.
But fair enough. Fair enough. Your microphone, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Debbie, thank you for coming and testifying about your circumstances, because it helps to give a real face and story to the circumstances. Now, if I understood right, because you counted your last 3 months of income, although you're unemployed now, you don't qualify for the Oregon Health Plan. Mm-hmm. Will you qualify a few months from now for that plan?
We started that in November, because my client died in November, and that's when I was first denied. I reapplied in January, and I'm $25 over the limit, even though I'm getting minimum unemployment right now.
So it's your unemployment that puts you over the limit right now. Okay. Ballpark estimate on what your monthly medications and health care costs? And do you have a sense of that?
I have no idea.
Okay. I've had a number of people in my office who have an income that puts them over the limit, but their income is dwarfed by their medical expenses. They're just their drugs only, and that's an impossible position to be in. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Adrian, in the last year or so, has your job changed dramatically? Are you having more calls, more denials? More people sounding like they're really desperate for health care?
All of the above, yes. We get more calls. We get. I'm not on the phone bank. We do have a group of people who are phone bank people. They answer generic questions for people. They get the brunt of phone calls from extremely desperate people. I don't even want to go into that part, but... They were very stressed. The phone bank people have been extremely stressed out. They kind of shield the workers from it to a degree, but we still get our share of equally desperate people. We have the clients can dial directly to our extension, and so we get our share of unhappy, desperate, frustrated people, angry people too. And it has increased.
Last question.
Sure.
Adrian, how long have you been doing this, this service for the state?
Since the fall of 99.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think we've all received similar type phone calls, and I mean, they're very difficult, they're very stressful, and Adrian does this on a professional basis every day. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, do we happen to have the mother of an assistant attorney general with us?
Let's get this information.
And, let's call up Phyllis Rand at the same time. Now, see, you guys don't know which one is. I mean, I'm not trying to disclose personal information here.
Mr. Chairman.
And you're not writing any of that, Peter.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my husband and I are real proud of our grandchildren and both our kids.
He's doing good.
We try not to tangle the lines. My name's Ruth Shepherd, and I live in Salem. Had a fair amount of experience in this building for about 37 years, and a fair amount of comprehensive health planning in my background. I'm kind of departing from substantive remarks about the recommendations, although at the end on it, there are some questions about your report to us. As the hole in our boat gets bigger and bigger, I think there are a lot of us that feel like we need to thank you for staying with it. It is all the words we use. It's unbelievable. It's unprecedented. We're looking at something we've never seen before. So which way you go is everybody's dilemma. You're in a situation with, you're in the life rafts, and as the boat gets more swamped, you try to decide between a heart patient and somebody who can't move to get out of bed. Or you might even be pretty soon getting close to judging whether you take the person with a gun who's likely to kill themselves or choose the person with a gun who might kill us. Nonetheless, I really come to you with a strong feeling that most of us have, and that is I really love this state. I have a license plate that's GR8ST8, and I'm very proud of going around the state as I've done in every county, and we've traveled it even with learned attorneys and the family, camping and fishing and enjoying it very much. And when you get home by air, when you come back to Oregon, you just have a special feeling when you see the sisters or Mount Hood. There's no question about it. And I have a high regard. I'm trying to think how come, but I think it's, and it might be a mystical feeling, but it's resided in us for all the time we've lived in Oregon, which is 57 years. Nonetheless, we are in deep trouble, and the reality is that we have an unprecedented mess. And the way that we save our state may be our best hope. The way you do business is as important as the business, maybe. At the same time that we are saluting your caring and your time spent, we know you're getting to more and more difficult decisions, and that your own personal values that brought you here are more on the table and exposed raw than they've probably ever been. So at the same time we salute your caring and all that, we have great hope that with a little push, the interpersonal skills of our 90 or so elected officials, and maybe their willingness to rise above the ground battles, will lead the way for us. We have finally recognized the chaos. Almost everybody in the building has, almost everybody. So we must not do any more harm. Doesn't do any good to play the blame game, which is so tempting. And so we can't continue the sloganizing even when we go home. And there's somehow a challenge to lift ourselves up, sermonizing, and maybe slow down, but keep going back to the table and recognizing that the blending of all those legitimate and treasured personal values are at the heart of any public policy decision. Speed and time have both been the drivers of this mess. So could we possibly bypass the political value of claiming a short session and help each other save face by slowing down? Since shortfalls in revenue are also big drivers of policy and program, could we possibly designate certain policies that we're going in and saying, they're all bad, as you said yesterday, they're all bad. Could we possibly identify some of them as short-term bad ones with a specific terminal date that may even be keyed to the CPI and the recovery of our economy? Some hope of retrieval for the future. Therein is the end of my sermonizing. I have some questions about your deliberations here and the reports that have come from your stakeholders groups, both of them. Essentially, I wonder where the impact and ripple effect goes, and it seems like it's extruding and moving back and forth across the whole budget. Maybe you have a better handle than those of us who listen to you a lot and watch you, but it does seem that if, for instance, the elderly rental assistance program is shoved overboard, that it will have a direct and immediate effect on other services that are there. And we can't predict with accuracy what those are going to be, unfortunately. Someday I hope we could. And ripple effects like the factors of bed occupancy in nursing homes and the bed occupancy in hospitals, the cost shifting or shafting, as some people call it. The change possibly in nursing home reimbursements and the effect that may very well have on home care or on hospitalization. I look at this from a lofty position of having been in and out of the emergency room 7 times in 11 months and am finally home free, never mind the stack of pills. And it's an uncomfortable position because we're lucky. And we look at the population of, what, 150 that we're going to drop, is that the proposal? 150,000. And wonder about that because they're your kids and my kids, not specifically, I have to say quickly, who have grown up in all different parts of this state, from the hills in Portland to Bend and every part of your territories. And they've grown up and they hear voices. And they have had their first and second or their 100th episode. And we're leaving them untouched. And they're our kids. It has no origin. The relationship of those extreme cases has very little relationship to where they came from. To say nothing of the kids, that little kids that are now hearing voices or that show every indication of being mentally ill. So I do have some specific questions and refer you to the revenue suggestions on the next page, only because I just don't see how a single decision can be approached in your deliberations without that being the integral piece, the piece that's driving decisions. That's backwards. If you have a plan for OHP and for mental health, then the question arises, what or who is going to do something about the remaining programs and policies in human services, and especially long-term care? Where will that come from? And since it's an integral part of the health plan, I mean, the relationships are intertwined and tied like knots together, how are those, the continuity of those programs going to be assessed, if at all? I think I just would leave it at that point. I have questions about some of your deliberations and the specific recommendations. But as I said, I have great hopes, too, as many of us do, that you can slow this pace and use time as a valuable, valuable tool. It will take some explaining. I think you're up to that.
Questions for Ruth?
Thanks for the sermon.
Pardon?
Thank you for the sermon.
Ruth, I've forgiven one before.
A couple of comments or observations The first of all, we in this committee, this process, indeed, Oregonians have been afforded a very unique opportunity with this committee. And decisions or lack thereof that did not allow for a more comprehensive look at other aspects of the social service safety net, I don't want to guess at or venture at. I think as we go forward, you know, with this, a lot of eyes are on this committee and this structure, this committee structure, to see how well it would work and if this would be a new way of approaching the ways and means budgeting process. So they have shouldered us enough responsibility here with the OHP and mental health delivery system, and I will allow that it is extraordinarily difficult just in those two, not to minimize their significance, but just in those two specific budget areas to do what we are doing. I say that fully recognizing the wisdom of your words and the and how interconnected most of those individual budgets are. But I think if we are successful in our task, and you notice here that there are, quote, additional committee members. Representative Cruz has invited down his Health and Human Service Committee, and almost every one of them is here almost every day. So hopefully in this, if you want to term it a pilot committee, we will be able to demonstrate that this is a model that works more efficiently for Oregon. That's the only answer I can give you as to, you know, why this wasn't more comprehensive in its approach.
Representative Weston, I want to be on record as saying that my view is that the need for overhaul of the department, careful planning of all the pieces of it, has long been there, and the record will show that I've spent a lot of time trying to get that done. And I'm one who believes in zero-based budgeting, but I'm certainly aware through public administration training and so forth that to try all of that in a few weeks is beyond comprehension.
Yeah, I think many of us, I will echo a sentiment of many of us, we'd be very willing to go through the five special sessions again if we had a year between the September special session and when we gaveled in. You also mentioned a couple of other things with regard to cost shifting, and we're all aware of that. And the issue there is we can quantify that to some extent. I mean, we can get the numbers. What gets left out of that equation is how do you quantify the human suffering that comes with it.
We have to improve the database.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
But hey, go ahead.
Go ahead, sir. Ruth, I've relied on you for both information and wisdom over time, and now I'm struggling as a freshman member of this body trying to understand the dynamics. I campaigned in 2000 on keeping the kicker to deal with these kinds of things. I campaigned in 2002 with the perspective that there wasn't enough revenue in the system. And I'm not sure that's universally agreed to around this table, around any table in this house yet. But ultimately, I think in our heart of hearts, we're going to come to the notion that there's not enough revenue in the system to deal with what we all perceive as human needs of the system. I'd like you to consider, you've observed this legislature through a lot of different periods and senses, and I ponder how at the national level we can be so willing to spend $1 trillion on a war in Iraq. Whether we agree with the war or we don't agree with the war isn't the issue. The issue is we're quite willing to put $1 trillion or so into that
or maybe it's 800 billion or some number. And we're talking about, if it's a trillion, Oregon's share would be about 10 billion of that. And we seem quite willing. This isn't a Republican or a Democrat issue. This is pretty well received in the United States Congress. We're going to have this war and we're going to spend that money. But we can't get the same consensus in this building that adding $2 or $3 billion to the budget in some way over this next biennium and perhaps through other bienniums is feasible, even for those of us who believe it's appropriate. I wonder if you might just sort of reflect on your observation over time in this building as to what made it possible at some times for the Legislative Assembly to go to the citizens and ask more of them than we seem to be willing to go to the citizens and ask of them in terms of social responsibility right now. I mean, do you have any reflections on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick, I presume you want the short answer.
Well, we can have the long answer later.
5,000 words or less.
Yes or no.
As long as it's shorter than the questions.
Well,
although it was a very good question.
It was a good question, but Representative Greenlick, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I truly don't see much difference in values. Those are value judgments you're talking about, and that's why I'm glad you did ask the question, because it underlines some of the things I was saying. We are a mix of people in this building, and we reflect the mix of Oregonians. And the value that says, for instance, if you need a program, then raise the tax for it. Or the value that says if you need a program and you don't have any money, you don't get it. Or if you're driven to come to Salem because the majority of voters heard you say that there will be no new taxes or that you want to shrink government, that's gone on forever. And it will, I presume. And that's the public discussion that's got to go on. We're not going to settle it here. I personally believe that educating the public is the big challenge, and becoming better communicators is the only way. That isn't to mean that there isn't a time when it's appropriate to have no new taxes. But I don't think the voters are sending people to Salem on the basis of a very large or global understanding of issues.
You know, Ruth, you mentioned in your statement that your sermon that almost everyone in this building has recognized the severity of the problem. And I think one of the challenges, and this strikes to the heart of Representative Greenlick's question, is have Oregonians recognize the seriousness of the problem. Now, they may have different responses to it, but have we taken that first step towards a recognition of the problem? We as a people.
Mr. Chair, I think I know what you mean by problem, but it'd be good for us to make sure that you mean that there's a shortfall that is crippling our state.
Correct.
Yeah. No, I don't think we're believed beyond the building yet. And it's partly because, in some ways, we failed the responsibility to deal with our helpers, the communicators of the world and the press, in an open and honest fashion that has Oregonians at the top of the list rather than re-election.
I actually think I was quite pleased with the coverage in the last cycle, if you will, with regard to 28. I thought the press pretty much got it right in terms of outlining the severity of the problem and that, folks, this is real.
I agree.
But I think that strikes to the heart of the issue, and a question that is not answerable at this juncture is, have Oregonians, you know, come to fully understand the impacts, you know, of the budget shortfall, and then what's the response?
Yeah, if I just comment, what I fear is that our generation, my generation, and Ruth's generation, grew up in the shadow of the Great Depression, and we learned from our parents that nobody lives alone in society. That we all, if we want to live in a society, there are prices we pay. And that altruism wasn't something special, it was just a survival tool. And what I fear is that we've lost a generation that understands that altruism is a survival tool. And what frightens me the most, the nightmare I have, is that people do understand the severity of the situation in Oregon, but that they deal with the cognitive dissonance by saying things that appear that they don't deal with, that they don't recognize it. I mean, that would be the worst nightmare, is that the citizens do believe that the Oregon Health Plan is in the position it is and that other services are, and that they somehow think it's okay for that to happen. And I don't know that that's true, Mr. Chair, but it really... it is what I wake up in the middle of the night worrying about. And if so, how we failed this last generation.
Well, and I mean, you're talking about a loss of the value of a sense of community and place. And I pray you are wrong.
Me too.
The only remarks you made I'd take umbrage with are the fact, the characterization of your age. Let's face it, Green Lake, you were an old man in the Depression. So.
I was... when it officially ended.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick is right on again. I grew up in a four-generation family because the grandmother and the great-grandmother were widows and there was no Social Security.
Right.
But it's not, I'm not suggesting a family responsibility law.
Well, but, I mean, you know.
Oh, God.
Traditional cliché-ish remark, breakdown of, you know, of the extended family and social implications. Phyllis, what do you have for us today?
First of all, I'd like to digress just a bit. I'm Phyllis Rand, and I'm going to, then I'll introduce who I'm attached to in a few minutes. But I want you to know that I'm a native Oregonian, and that I was born and raised in Portland, and have been around the legislature since 1959. That's a long time ago. Ruth and I are approximately the same age.
No,
she,
I've got it on you.
No, not much. In June, I'll be 78.
Oh, okay. Then.
So she has a few months on me, is all. And we've been friends for many years. But I want to say that I don't have a son that's an attorney general, but I have a son. I have a son who is a well-known jazz musician in Portland, and I just wanted to share that with you. And Warren Rand plays an alto saxophone and plays with Mel Brown and Lloyd Jones and a whole bunch of musicians. And obviously you can tell I'm very proud of him. When I started working at the legislature, I started out as a page in the Senate. And then I was the doorkeeper and then the messenger to the House and then eventually in the 70s became the receptionist for the Senate for a couple of sessions. And always been involved with the community and the politics here in Oregon, and have lived in Oregon almost all of my life, except for maybe 6 months or 8 months that we lived in Fort Benning, Georgia. And I'm proud to be an Oregonian, and I love it here. And I want to see us get out of this difficult time that we're in. Now I'm going to introduce myself as Phyllis Rand. I'm the capital coordinator for the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. And today I'm bringing you a series of concerns that the commission has and also some recommendations. And I'm going to start out with the back end of my notes first, saying that the commission is recommending the following things. We support effort for cost containment. That's first thing. However, it cannot be the only source of revenue to provide developmental disabilities, mental health and addiction services, prescription drug coverages. The legislature must raise revenue. We support efforts to reduce and eliminate tax credits. And we also have been pushing for a number of years to for wine and beer tax to be increased. That's not been very popular, but that's an issue that the commission has had. And I think that's how it was when Representative Westland was on the commission. But I also want to talk about the fact that we've discussed caring for 350,000 people. I think the commission thinks that that needs to include the other 150 people who were on the Oregon Health Plan. But total picture, it's difficult to separate out a piece, a segment, because you can't just say Joe Blow has these symptoms, because you have to treat the whole person. It's so important, because some of those seniors, some of those people with disabilities, some low-income families with children and elders and other insured people have more than one issue. I mean, you're going to have seniors, and they're going to have they're going to have problems with getting around, maybe making their bed, maybe even getting out of their bed. But you also have drug and alcohol problems. You also have mental health problems, and they're all interrelated. You know, I don't know how you can draw a line and not serve the people because you aren't putting your arms around the whole picture. And until we can do that, until we can give those people who need, people with disabilities who need oxygen and need wheelchairs and need ways to get around, we're in big trouble. And in society, responsibility to care for those who cannot care for themselves is the responsibility of their government. And I would hate to see that we can't meet that responsibility. That would make the commission feel very uncomfortable, and me too. That's really all I have to say, except I understand that instead of 127 million that we're short to add those pieces for the mental health and chemical dependency and those pieces, is really 163 million. So we have to think out of the box. We have to look at resources that will bring us into a position where we can care for the people we need to care for. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Phyllis?
I just wanted to comment, Phyllis, and Ruth, you folks are right on, and your concern for the 150,000 who aren't covered is something I'm very concerned about, and so we're not just 163 million short, we're an extra 250 million short, at least, of the other.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative March, I think one of the concerns that's widespread is the speed with which the decision is made, and then because of a whole series of constraints, the need to give notification quickly and be dropped has happened to so many people, whereas we could probably take a vow that it will never happen again. We did have warning signs some 2 to 3 years ago, and you wonder what would have happened if we'd taken it to a point where there would have been some planning possible. But it's been injurious, I think, to most groups of clients.
And in some cases, dropped and put back on.
That's not worse, but it has its hazards.
Well, it's...
Right.
It's good to go back on, but, I mean, there's a cost to that as well. Any other questions? I have a note here. Phyllis, can you have Warren score me some tickets for the next Ozzy Osbourne concert? Signed, Ellen Lowe.
Ellen has known our family for a long time.
Well, what's the answer to the question? Susan King.
Good afternoon, Chair West.
Get that thing real close.
All right.
You can pull it out from the the cord out. At least I think you can.
I think not.
Okay.
All right. I'll just hunch over. Good afternoon. My name is Susan King. I am a registered nurse representing the Oregon Nurses Association. What I'm here to do today is just make a request to you. I'm unfortunately becoming, I guess, a bit of a historian. I'm sitting here listening to the discussions today and have on previous days and reflecting back to the late 80s when my organization and I, as their representative, helped construct the original Oregon Health Plan. And now I'd like to go back in time 10 years because we really had it good then, even though we didn't know that. We also worked over the last 10 years or so to make sure we continued to fund the Oregon Health Plan by supporting such things as tobacco tax, particularly when they weren't popular, and really trying to do the best we could to serve the most people. I know that that's a goal that you have as well. In my life away from the Oregon Nurses Association, I work in an emergency department. So I see firsthand every day that I'm practicing the effects of many of our policies, and particularly when funding is cut, there's an almost immediate effect on the patients that I serve. We see more people without other resources. We see people coming to emergency departments for illnesses that are not severe. They don't know that, but we are sort of the place that they know they won't be turned away. So all of the state policies that we discuss in the abstract here in this building, I see the effect on the ground. I certainly, as a nurse, recognize the enormity of the task and the limited amount of time that you have to do it. None of us, I know, believe that we would be in the crisis that we are today 2 or even 4 years ago, although, as some have mentioned before, we saw it coming.
Susan, could you hold on a second?
Uh-huh.
Gwyneth, do you have to leave?
We have to leave in 15 minutes.
We'll get you up next.
I'll be very brief. I'm just about finished. I'm not here specifically to talk about any one service, but I need to say that the Oregon Nurses Association believe that whatever Oregon health plan exists when this legislature finishes its work, it has to include physical health, mental health, prescription drug coverage of some sort, durable medical equipment, and chemical dependency. We don't see those as operating independently. No individual generally that I see has any one problem, but a host of interrelated problems. If we're going to maintain a prioritized list as the approach to delivering services through the Oregon Health Plan, you simply can't say, well, it won't have prescription drugs on it. That list is constructed using condition treatment pairs, and treatment in many cases for many conditions involves drugs. I'm also not taking a position on any one approach for funding. My organization has and will support a variety of approaches, and I know you're looking at those, such things as the formulary, which we support. I guess I'm not supposed to call it a formulary. Changes in reimbursement policies, care delivery options, residency requirements, new revenue, whether it's beer and wine taxes or whether it's payroll taxes, income taxes, we believe all of those should be on the table, as well as in administrative efficiencies. In our view, the Oregon Health Plan is the single most important health policy that we have in Oregon. We were part of the construction of it, and so we are asking you that as we deconstruct it and defund it, and then we work together to reconstruct and refund, we want this process to be done in as public a way as it can be. We want all of the assumptions to put on the table, all ideas put on the table, and we're urging you to keep this process as open, as public as possible, so that all of the trade-offs, the underlying assumptions, the decisions we make are explicit. If those decisions are explicit, then those of us who are seeing every day on the ground how this policy works out can give you our best advice and our best recommendations and not give them to you at the last minute. So we're just encouraging you to please keep us as informed as you can about the decisions you're making, and then allow us to tell you what we think of those decisions and perhaps give you others. Thank you.
That's a fair request. Any questions for Susan real quickly? Well, Gwyneth, where'd you go? Is Maria Kelly in?
I can't write.
Marcia Kelly.
This is Marcia?
This is Marcia.
Oh, we need some remedial help here. Or new spectacles.
Better.
Yeah,
better.
Or maybe new glasses. That could be part of the problem.
That's not fair.
Well, look, volunteer effort, little sense of community here, tight budget. She needs help.
My name is Marcia Kelly. I've been sitting in the committee almost without fail every single day. I represent the Women's Rights Coalition of Oregon, which is made up of the American Association of University Women of Oregon, the Oregon Women's Political Caucus, the Older Women's League, or OWL, Delta Kappa Gamma, the Salem YWCA, Oregon Now, and individual members. American Association of University Women has 30 branches in the state, east of the mountains, on the coast, in the northeast, the northwest, and the northeast corridors. So we're not just an organization. We're not an organization made up just up and down I-5. I'm a native Oregonian, a second generation native Oregonian, born in Bend, in the old St. Charles Hospital. And I'm here to say that the approach that was given to you for looking at the Oregon Health Plan is not necessarily the approach that I would take as an elected official. The Oregon Health Plan is good policy. And when looking at what you want to do with the Oregon Health Plan, you need to look at the policy and see what you can do, and then you need to look at the funding. And I'm concerned that the look that was given by the subcommittee was based on the funding first and the policy maybe second. I know of where I speak. I have been an elected official for 13 or 14 years in a minor little position, and we've faced crunches. And part of the thing that is not being articulated in Oregon about our funding crisis is where we got, how we got here. Ballot Measure 5 impacted my special district. We almost had to cut services. We had to go to a special levy in order to maintain services. In Oregon, with Ballot Measure 5 gradually being ratcheted down for the school districts, we didn't realize the effect that Ballot Measure 5 would have. And we haven't articulated that effect in the cost of doing business and doing government in Oregon very well to our citizens. We also had Ballot Measure 11, which impacted what happens with the state general fund. And again, we talk about the growth of government in Oregon, but not necessarily where that came from. So I am here to ask you, like others, to slow down, to look at the policy, and then look at the revenues. And I'm not advocating for any particular one revenue. I'm not advocating necessarily for a new revenue. I do think that as Oregonians, we should all look at the amount that we do not collect from taxes that are on the book because of tax breaks. I'm not saying every tax break is bad, but there are tax breaks that may have the better common good. And I'm going to leave with you what I read every time I walk into the front door of the building. It's located on the left-hand side. A free state is formed and is maintained by the voluntary union of the whole people, joined together under the same body of laws for the common welfare and the sharing of benefits justly appointed. And maybe if you said that every day before you started making your decisions in the chambers, it might help. So I'm going to give you a copy that you can look at.
And I notice you didn't read that.
I sort of did. But I look at it every morning.
Looked to me like that came not only from the mind, but also from your heart. And had I known you were born in Bend, I would have realized that was Marcia. Any questions for Marcia? Thank you. Okay, Gwyneth and Elizabeth Byers. And Gwyneth, when you sign in, use your whole name.
Well, I haven't put my middle name in there yet, so if you want the whole name, I don't think there's room on the line.
All right.
So good afternoon, and thank you for letting us speak, making room for us. My name is Gwyneth Griffiths Van Frank Carlson.
All right.
And I'm from Eugene, Oregon. And I have been very appreciative of the fact that you all have been dealing with my issues, which is why I've been behaving myself lately. I would like to give you just a little background so that you understand why I've come to Salem and have spent so much time here. And it does relate to this issue. I moved here in 1978, and I was visually impaired at the time. I encountered a lot of discrimination and resistance in my own home state of Utah in terms of getting out into the mainstream and working. So I came to Oregon and found an incredible climate of progressive independent living awareness. And that extended also to our governor at the time, Bob Straub, and the legislature. And there was a lot of collaboration amongst disability rights advocates and the legislature and the governor to form programs that were good policy, that were cost-effective, and that continued through the 80s, even though we had a much deeper recession then than we do now. I understand that the tax structure was different then. We had not passed ballot measure 5 or ballot measure 11, and the programs that had been developed in the late 70s and early 80s were continued here without the kind of disruption that's been present in this building on occasion lately. Although there is a long tradition of civil rights activism in the disability rights community, and it has been actively done in many other states. But this state, it hasn't been necessary because we've had such a collaboration between our government and people with disabilities somehow or other that arrangement and that policy has been slipping. And it needs to be understood that the people with disabilities in this state have benefited, have grown, and have been productive by the policies that have been present here in the state. And I'm here to encourage you, as the previous speaker did, to please continue your policy making based on what is right and what is required by a society for a proper safety net, an adequate safety net. And not to base your policy making on revenue available, because there is an abundance of of resources in this state, and when it's properly apportioned and spread amongst the people in a way where it provides that safety net, even for the wealthy, who once they may end up dealing with a disability will find themselves not so wealthy. It's not cheap to have a disability. And they will be very grateful to have a safety net as well. So I really support the work you're doing, and I hope that you will think of public policy first, and that bottom line is so much more important than the amount of revenue that it'll take to fund it. Because if you base your policy making on a philosophy of shared caring and apportionment of resources, then you can interpret the Constitution the other way than the way you've interpreted it, so that you can raise revenues to pay for programs that are proper. Thank you.
Gwyneth, thank you very much. Any questions for Gwyneth?
No, thanks.
Elizabeth?
Good evening, Chair Westland and committee members. My name is Elizabeth Byers. I'm here right now representing the Mental Health Association of Oregon. It's a group of consumers, people who use mental health services, and people who have mental health disabilities. I wish I had been here sooner, been here in the stakeholders' meetings, and been able to participate better, because I think that people who are consumers of the services are going to be the best explanation about what works and what doesn't work. And that's what I want to give you right now, just a little picture of what we think works. I want to support community clinics in people's communities where they're, where the staff is people in the community, people that clients come in contact with in their environment where they feel comfortable, are always more successful. There's less needs for hospitalizations and other costly interventions. We also think home care supports work. They keep people in their homes. They help people to meet the benchmarks for high functioning to be able to stay in their homes, help them pass inspections, help them keep up with requirements that over time for hygiene, but also for other kinds of community standards, and allow people to stay in their homes with a minimum of more costly interventions. And we want people to be educated and informed about meds and treatment. That means people aren't over-medicating or under-medicating, and that means that people are making informed decisions about how to function appropriately in society. We think that when you create a program that doesn't give people these three components, then those folks with mental health disabilities, children with severe emotional disorders, and people who are working to be clean and sober and contributing members of our community all are going to be lost without having access to these services. So I want to thank you very much for your time and listening to Consumer Voice.
We thank you for your time and your commitment to be here, both of you. Any questions for Elizabeth? Excellent testimony.
Thank you.
Thank both of you. Lynn Marie. I hardly recognized you without your red beret.
Good morning. I wish I could bring a lot of information to this package. But thank you for your work on it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Lynn Marie Kreider, Research Director at the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I'm testifying based on the report that some of you made to the full committee late last week concerning the preliminary work done by the informal working group. Appreciate the fact that the group is continuing to pursue saving strategies that might make it possible to include prescription drugs, mental health, chemical dependency, and durable medical equipment in the package of services available to the mandatory populations under the Oregon Health Plan. But we believe it is unacceptable. It is unacceptable to us, and we believe it is unacceptable to you, for Oregon to abandon the effort to provide basic health services to those who are not categorically eligible for Medicaid. And you've heard a lot of sermons this morning, so maybe I'll forego mine and go on to make some suggestions about maybe how we get there, because I think, you know, there needs to be a realistic path and not just an exhortation here. I guess two specific things that I would like to suggest are, one, that the committee needs to pursue additional revenue for this program, recognizing that because healthcare costs are increasing while state revenue is not, that new revenue will be necessary if we are to continue to provide any kind of benefit for non-mandatory populations. The Oregon AFL-CIO would support some kind of a provider tax to fund services under the Oregon Health Plan. We know that such a tax would be passed on to us because our members are covered in commercial plans, and we'll pay for such a tax. But we would rather pay the tax in that form than we would to pay it in the form of an indirect tax, which would be the tax that we bear when we absorb the cost shift for uncompensated care. If you tax, then we have the federal match, and we've done a more costly. The tax on us is worth more to the community of all Oregonians. So that makes sense to us. The other thing that we would suggest to you is that a bill has been introduced in this legislature, and I think it was finally printed today, House Bill 3285, which is something that we've worked on. The idea is to do a payroll tax on employers to pay to cover all kids in the Oregon Health Plan. I know you're not accustomed to thinking about expanding coverage, but this is, I think, a win-win situation. We propose to assess a 2% payroll tax on all employers. That would pay for, using federal matching dollars, covering all kids, either in the Oregon Health Plan or providing subsidies to employers who choose to cover kids in employer-based coverage. At the same time, because it would pay for covering all kids, it would replace the general fund dollars that we now spend to cover kids. That is, 2 out of every 9 kids in Oregon is on the Oregon Health Plan now. If we can pay for those kids with a new source of revenue, we have what looks to me like about $140 million in revenue that we can use to do what we need to do for the new eligible population. Now, I think $140 million is not enough to provide the current benefit for that new eligible population. But I think the second thing I want to suggest to you is that you look at rethinking how you do a benefit for that new eligible or OHP standard population. I served on the waiver application steering committee a year and a half ago, so I went through that very difficult process of trying to figure out how, with what revenue looked like then, we would do a benefit for that population. And I frankly think, in retrospect, that it probably wasn't the best way to do it, but I think we all felt like we were limited by the way that the bill came out, and I think we were optimistic also about what cost sharing would do to save the plan. And I think that in retrospect, I would urge that we think about a pared back package of benefits instead of a cost sharing approach to doing coverage for those folks. And I included as an attachment to my testimony a proposal that some of us made in the context of that. It's the letter without letterhead that's dated November 20, 2001. And basically, it was a group of us from, CARE Oregon, the Oregon AFL-CIO, the Oregon Law Center, et cetera. And basically, what we suggested at that time, and it was found by the Attorney General not to be consistent with 2519, so the WASC couldn't go forward with it, but I think if you're ready to pass a new bill, perhaps we could do something like this, which was basically to say, we need physician services, we need mental health, chemical dependency, pharmacy. Maybe we don't provide some of the specialized services. Maybe we don't cover hospitalization. But we get people the kinds of services that are most cost effective given the limited resources, that are likely to keep people who are on the edge from dropping off the edge and going into a hospital. An awful lot of that population that's on OHP standard, as you well know, are people that have chronic conditions, that if we treat them in cost-effective primary care ways, we can prevent more serious stuff. I'd like to see a full benefit. I'm not suggesting to you that that's not the ideal, but I am suggesting that if we can't afford it, maybe we go back to a primary care style benefit, the kind of benefit that I think Dr. Bates mentioned the other day to the committee that was done in the Utah waiver. Just penciling it out, when we did this proposal in November of 2001, we said that we thought we could do a basic benefit package for about $100 per member per month. You will see, we were, and we anticipated some cost sharing in that proposal because we were making this proposal for the population over 100% of poverty. We were suggesting that this would be the kind of package you could do for people, for the expansion population that we were then talking about covering. Now we're talking, I think, about what would a basic benefit be for people that are under 100% of poverty, the current OHP standard population, rather than the additionals that we were hoping to cover. If we're doing a basic benefit for the really low-income folk, I don't think you would want to do the cost sharing that's suggested here. That means that it's more than $100 per member per month, I think. And I haven't tried to go back and pencil that out. I simply suggest that I think it's more than 100. But even if it were 150 per member per month, that's still half what the full benefit package costs. And I think you could cover the current standard population with a benefit like that for the $140 million in state money that we're talking about in the kids program to wrap back to a proposed source of revenue. I don't know what a provider tax would generate for you, but I think we need to think about what is the revenue that we can produce and what's the kind of package that we can afford and that gets us the most for the dollars that we can produce. And I would be more than happy to help in any way I could to put together something that makes sense for Oregon.
Any questions? Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the assumptions that you address is that, or ideas that you address is, I may have lost it now, is that the program can be run more efficiently by going to a private provider. I'm assuming you're not talking about the actual provision of the health care because that's already largely private, but are you referring to administration?
You're looking at the testimony that I gave to the Senate committee last week, which I attached. I was trying to talk about some of the arguments that have been historically made about why the Oregon Health Plan is in trouble and to suggest, and I actually haven't heard very much of that this session, so I probably shouldn't have included that. Last session there was a lot of talk about how privates could do it better. I think we're now recognizing that healthcare costs are going through the roof, and no matter who's doing it, it's going to cost a lot of money. So I'm sorry if that was...
Thank you.
Small wordsmithing issue on that flawed assumptions piece.
Uh-huh.
Point number three, like I say, is a small wordsmithing. You can save money in OHP by lopping off categories and benefits. I think you can save money in OHP by eliminating categories and benefits. Doesn't mean you're going to save money.
I don't think you can save money in the long haul. I think you end up, when we lock off things like pharmaceutical coverage and mental health coverage, I think it's going to wrap back and cost you someplace else in the system.
I agree with that statement, but that's not what you say in point three.
If I didn't say it correctly, I stand corrected, Mr. Chair.
Like you say, small wordsmithing issue. Additional question. In your 3285, a 1.5% tax on payroll. Does that include all payrolls? Are you getting it self-insured here?
Mr. Chairman,
talk to me a little bit about that.
The 1.5% tax on payroll would be on all wages paid by employers for employees working in Oregon, and it would include self-employment income as well. And then the scheme is that children could enroll in the Oregon Health Plan, or if their parents' employer provided family health coverage, then they could enroll in that coverage, and that employer would receive a tax credit, which we believe in most cases would cover the full cost. It would cover the full cost of that.
That 140 in GF looks awfully small to me for 1.5%. Not to quibble over numbers.
The $140 million?
Yes.
The $140 million would be the general fund savings for not having to provide the coverage we currently provide in the Oregon Health Plan. No, I think the budget would be over $1 billion. I mean, I think the 1.5%
would produce
a little over $1 billion. That's guessing what the total payroll is at this point because the data's a little old.
I think that's pretty close. Okay, and I see. I misread. Any other questions for Lynn? Representative Merkley.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. You speak to the fact that copays are a real barrier to health care for the poor. We had brief experience with OHP standard with copays. Having seen that in action, did people abandon the plan as a result of the copays or fail to go to the doctor because of the copays? Or did we in fact see that proved to be a significant barrier?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I'm not sure I'm the best source or that we had enough experience with it, frankly, to answer that question.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Lynn, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any comments for the good of the order? Seeing no other business to come before the committee? And before I do adjourn, I want to thank everyone that came today very much. We're adjourned.